Oral History Project. Today is March 8, 1979. Tonight I'm talking with Mr. Joseph Udovsky. Mr. Udovsky was born September 11, 1911 in Lithuania. He presently lives on Valletta Lane in Louisville, Kentucky. His parents were Simon and Mary Udovsky. Mr. Udovsky, under what circumstances did you come to America?
Well, my father was here since 1911 in Louisville. He came to meet his sister, who was married with children. He came before him. They came to Louisville in 1906. My father and mother built a house in Lithuania, and they had a hard time paying off the mortgage. So he thought he'll come to the United States and make some money, help pay the mortgage. And while he was here, he didn't make that much money. And meanwhile, World War started in 1914, just soon afterwards, and everything stopped, all kind of traveling and things like that, it stopped completely. So we haven't heard from during the whole war, which lasted to 1918 in America. And of course we had quite a bit of trouble in Lithuania. First were the Russians leaving the city, burning the city, and then the Germans came in, traveled back and forth day and night, thousands, millions of soldiers through. And what the Russians left burning, they started up all over again. So the biggest part of the city was burned, and all the records and everything from school with it. And the people over there had a very hard time during the war. The military took over everything, what it belonged to the private people. Everything had to go to the army, to the German army. So the ones who didn't live up to it were severely punished. Death was shooting in the court, and the main market was the usual thing. Anyone who disobeyed the rules and orders. And there was also a number of diseases being broken out. Military, so the number of vaccinations were going on. I guess my hand is just full, all checked up, and vaccinations no longer, 4 or 5 times being vaccinated.
And you received all those as a very young child?
As a young child, everything. When the war was over, then there wasn't sure who's going to control it. So there were certain bands, militaries breaking out from the German army and joining. One of my recall was under the name of General Kolchak, was a Czechoslovakia, and he just had some Germans and Russians and Hungarian soldiers with him trying to fight the communists who were trying to come over. And the communists came over to our city. They were there in our town named Kellen. And they had a tremendous battle there, and they succeeded in driving the communists further up Russia, all the way up there. And then the League of Nations formed, and they had a number of countries declared. So Lithuania was one of the old countries became, including Poland and some other small countries, Czechoslovakia, all that, Romania, and us to in all these countries. Anyway, things were never too good over there, especially for the Jewish people. They were accustomed to being afraid to walk on the other side of the street and see somebody else walking, because they were always afraid to be harmed and things like that. And so, after the war, my father decided we should bring the family over to Europe, because from Europe to the United States, my mother had her whole family there. She wasn't willing to go, so it took a number of years to do it. So finally, in 1925, she decided to come, because my oldest brother, Harry, who died just about 5 months ago recently, was getting to the age where he'd be drafted to the army, and then couldn't leave. So we left towards the end of the winter, just about this time of the year. It was in March, end of March, and we came the first stop. We was in Germany, Königsberg. And from Königsberg we went to Berlin. And we stayed there a couple of days. And then we went to Rotterdam, Holland. Yeah. And from Rotterdam we crossed the Channel. That was the worst part of our trip. To the English Channel, to England. It was an overnight trip. I never was so sick in all my life. My whole family was never so sick. And over there, when we came there, we had a great big super boat by the name of Berengaria. It's part of the Queen boat, Queen Elizabeth boats and all this. Was one of the biggest steamers there at that time. And we left it was Friday afternoon, and we got to New York City, Ellis Island, on following Friday. The trip was very miserable, except for one day it was very foggy. And the boat was hardly moving. That's the time I felt good. The rest of the time I was just as sick as could be. And we stayed in Ellis Island just for a few hours, and then they had a society by the name of HIAS. That means Hebrew Immigrants Association. And they took us to their office. We stayed there for Saturday, and we had a nice, quiet, pleasant day there. It was on East Broadway, New York, as they call it. All the immigrants used to come. And there was a few more immigrants with us. And then on Sunday, we got in the train. We went straight to Louisville.
What did you think of New York when you saw it?
Well, New York was really tremendous. Never saw anything like it. Never forget it. I was walking on the street and I found a penny, and I thought, oh, well, money is laying in the streets in America. But it was spring and it was really beautiful. In that time, people were nice and friendly. Most people in that neighborhood spoke Jewish, so we could converse with them very easily. And the people in the Hyatt were very nice immigrants. They spoke all kinds of languages, very friendly. So for... And when I came to Louisville, I was met my father and family, and then he had a house rented on Madison Street. was 411 East Madison, temporary house. It was right before the holidays of Passover, just about 10 days before. And we stayed there. We passed the holidays. We stayed there for a few extra months there, and then we find a little larger home on East Chestnut Street, 530 East Chestnut. At that time was very close to a school called the Thomas Jefferson School. In fact, all I had to do was climb the fence and go to school. I did not know how to speak a single word English or anything. Nevertheless, they put me, I was 13, they put me in third grade, 8, 9 year old children. But they were extremely nice, and we made a number of friends at that time. But I guess I wasn't interested too much in school, so when school is out, after school I used to go out, and I had a cousin who was selling papers on Fort Walnut, Abe Lines, and I was selling papers for him. He used to pay me a little quarter or so to help him sell papers. And then he introduced me to a number of other adventures, to sell, go to the races and sell racing forms, newspapers, and scratch sheets, and other things. And then they had, wrestling was very fashionable at that time, and they had a national theater on 5th and Walnut. We used to have wrestling matches there every week. So, starting to sell Cokes and many other soft drinks during intermission. That's in the winter time. And then in the summer, they also had one on Broadway to open up the arena. 800 block West Broadway for wrestling. And the promoter of that wrestling also had the concessions for soft drinks and food or so, by the man named Hyman. He was a junk dealer. His name probably you'll find in the records. He was a very important man in the junk business. He was dealer. So that, finally I wind up trying to get a job, so jobs were not available. So I find a part-time job for climbing furriers. They were at that time 618 South 4th Street. I was helping out, doing all kind of errands, helping out in the factory, paying $70 a week. But of course, I just kept on at night time, sell papers at night, and also go to wrestling matches and fights.
Still a young boy.
I was under 16. I was about 14 and a half. And while I was working for climbing, I was finally, somehow I learned the trade very fast. And in a short time, I became a cutter, fur cutter. The head of fur cutters. They had a number of people working there at that time. Then 1929, things got very bad with the stock market crash and everything else. So he had to lay off a number of help, like lay off everybody. So I also was laid off at the time. And he had a son in New York who went with his brother-in-law in manufacturing business, manufacturing furs, fur trimmings. He used to work, used to do the trimmings for fashionable clothing houses. People used to do the clothing, dressing for the movies at that time, silent movies, for Ziegfeld Follies, and also for the very fine Fifth Avenue stores, and very fine stores all over the country. He used to work mostly in ermine and sables, white ermine, sables, and many other fine furs. And he was in the same loft also was another furrier by the name of Gottlieb. He was a custom furrier. He used to take care of the finest women's trade in New York City. And there wasn't enough work for one of them, so I helped work to the other ones. So I learned quite a bit about the fur trade from being in the finest factories at that time. And of course, things were still not too good in New York, but nevertheless, I managed to save some money. With things going so slow, and I did save up to $700. And I also had a brother who was working in the fur shop here for Louisville Furriers. His name was Goldstein. And he lost his job. At that time, I was intent to go in business with a friend of mine, myself. Being my brother, had lost his job, and he was married, so
decided. Business in New York.
We were supposed to go in business in New York at the time. The business was just getting better. It's 1934, it's just getting better. So we were starting to specializing in merchandise that comes from China, which was inexpensive. We could make fur coats from some of their furs. Well, all this had to be broken up, and I came to Louisville, and we opened up a fur business in the Hayburn building. Mr. William Hayburn was very anxious to have us in the building, so he built a whole store for us in 1934. It was 709 South 4th Street. You're still there at the time. Also had another brother who used to work for Schrader Brothers. They were very famous cleaners at that time. They were on 7th and Chestnut. He was doing the fur work there. He was a furrier. So we decided all three of us to go together, become furriers. In order to get to work, we had been around to different stores and trying to get work. At that time, the department stores were selling a number of furs, but they did not have their own furriers. They didn't know how to feed them or repair them or style them. So I got a number of furriers from 4th Street. There's a number of tailors who were doing some fur work, got their jobs. Also went as far as Lexington. We had a big store at Embry, they did their fur work, and also went to Nashville, doing the work for Nashville. So we still took quite a bit of work that way, till we established ourselves, and we get more and more famous. So we're progressing every year somehow. And in 1937, the flood hit us, and managed somehow to get all the furs out from our store, bring it back up to the elevator. It wasn't working, and kind of the water was coming in the building. So we brought it up to the second floor in the Hebron building. And we stayed with the fur till the water was receding. It was, must have been about 12 days. Was getting colder every day, so we were walking up from one floor to the next floor. Finally went up to the 18th floor, which was still warmer because the boiler room was in the basement and everything was cold there. So,
did you keep moving the furs with you?
No, we kept moving the furs on the second floor, but the water only reached the first floor in the Hebron building. Only it's just about 7 feet.
It was kind of a fashion center in the neighborhood.
Yeah, even at that time they had the finest
shops.
They had the finest dress shops with Meriwether and Hennepin. They had the finest styles that New York and Paris has produced.
The Elvis Lay Shop?
The Elvis Lay Shop used to have. Because I also used to do the fur work for them. At that particular time, the Russian brotto was very fashionable, very expensive. I used to make a lot of coat specials already for them. And we were doing real well with the rest of them. My name was getting more popular because I had all the experience in New York, and there wasn't anyone trained as much as I have, training in for work. No one in Louisville had that much training up to this particular moment, as a matter of fact. So somehow my name was going stronger and stronger. But in Cincinnati, what we used to do to work for them, they decided they have so much work they would like to further of their own. So my oldest brother, Harry, so he went to work for Journey & Company. It was a very fashionable ladies' shop. They employed just about 300 people there in the dress shop and the clothing for together.
He
was a specialty store. He was taking care of all the furs, all the fur work, all the repairs and remodeling. And he stayed there for around 35 years until Jenny was bought out by...
That room, it wouldn't be local.
It was, isn't it? No, it was bought out. Had a store local, but I think the thing lasts longer. Jenny just came to call the name. So, Giddings, that became Giddings Jenny. So from there he just he moved to Columbus because his daughter was there and his grandchildren. They moved to Columbus, opened up a store, so that's how it happened. And we were still a little older and better every year business. My children were getting 4 or 5 years old. I was thinking perhaps we should open up a Jewish day school instead of him, because this way the children used to go to public school and then from there they used to spend the rest of the time in the Hebrew school, so it was too hard. I thought maybe they can do it all at one time, so they have got more time to play. And we were talking about it, and we got together a number of people who were interested in it. And we decided to have it in the Knesset Israel has the best facilities, Knesset congregation. They had some beautiful rooms, Sunday school rooms. We went as far as we even hired a kindergarten teacher. We had 30 children already signed up for the day school. Somehow the congregation itself, they were starting to be a split. Some of them wanted to have it called mixed sitting. I mean, Orthodox congregation, it was Orthodox congregation, and the younger people wanted to be more modern, they wanted the women and men sit together, and the older people were against it. So while the congregation were arguing, meanwhile, they had a meeting, they decided to lay off for the next meeting, but opening up the kindergarten and then the first grade for Jewish day school. So meanwhile, the argument between the congregation went on and on, and another meeting for the day school has never came up till 5 years afterwards. When a man by the name of Mr. Spivak, he wanted to have something in his father's memory, opens up some kind of educational program. So our committee talked to Mr. Spivak and he was interested in that. So we bought a house on Douglas, 2228 Douglas, which is, it was an old mansion that belonged to Colonel Levy from Levy Brothers. And we, Levy Brothers was belonged to old Fred Levy. At that time, we hired a teacher from New York and his principal. Wife, and the principal teacher named Rabbi Charner. And Mrs. Charner, he was the principal. Mrs. Charner was a teacher. Rabbi Charner was the principal, and Mrs. Charner was also a teacher, kindergarten teacher, and Rabbi Charner was teaching the first grade. And then the following year, we hired more teachers for the second grade, and then teachers for third grade, and so forth.
You had a grade a year.
At that time, the state wanted to take over the Hebrew school, and also the ritual bathhouse, which was at that time under the Wad Ha'ir. H-O-E-R. And the YMHA was on 2nd Street, 700 blocks second, south second. Was not large enough, and they had decided to build a new YMCA, so they could call it Jewish Community Center. So they picked that place in Dutchman's Lane, the present place right now. And they decided to have the Hebrew school there too. So they built special rooms for Hebrew school besides having the center as just like the YMHA. So there was no one there to take care of the ritual bathhouse.
Called the mikvah.
Mikvah. M-I-K-V-A.
H.
So they had a meeting at that Hebrew school on Walnut Street and decided to someone should take it over, to have charge of it. There wasn't anyone that wanted to take charge of it because it was a big responsibility. So they formed a called a meeting, and that was Rabbi Rudman told me to come to the meeting. It's a very important meeting. And there were several hundred people at that meeting. And they had, the meeting also was called for by the Vodakas, the one who used to do ritual slaughtering. We had some difficulties with getting persons to do the slaughtering, bring from out of town. And management and the one who had charge of it by the name of Mr. Goldstein, who was there for a number of years. In fact, he was about 18 years head of the ritual slaughtering. He was also president of the congregation Knesset Israel at the time. He resigned and wouldn't accept the job again, and no one wanted it. So one of the butchers suggested my name, and Rabbi Rudman said, I must take it. No, he's going to give all the help. So that's what when the trouble started. So when I became president. And at that time, we had chicken slaughtering on Preston Street. Preston and Fear, we had a special building there for slaughtering of fowl. And we had two kosher men who used to take
on the tape.
We had that mikveh on First Street, on First and Walnut, in Brooklyn Walnut, that was built in the turn of the century, 1907, was completed. And then also was housing, then later on in 1919, they took in the Hebrew school there. And they had a very successful Hebrew school. At times they had as much as 150 to 175. Boys and girls attending 6 days a week. And sometimes also they had services on Saturday. But as things went on, the became the biggest part of the building, and they took over the care of the ritual slaughter, the ritual bathhouse, mikveh, and they took complete care of it and maintained from paying the bills and everything like that. When they start building the new Jewish community center, the Hebrew school was decided to go in the center because the neighborhood was getting extremely bad on East Walnut Street. So the ritual bathhouse remained there, and there was no one there to take care of it. So the Vodakas was formed, as I said before, in 1953. And we undertook to take care of the mikveh, take complete the charge of it. It was a tremendous headache. We all said we had a lot of trouble there with vandalism, kept breaking windows all the time. As I said before, we had a chicken slaughtering on Preston Street, and the cattle slaughtering was done with a company by the name of Dawson Packing Company, Lexington Road. We had a rabbi, or what we call it, shochet. So C-A-C-T. And it's one. They used to alternate. 1 week in the chicken house and 1 week in the slaughterhouse to do the work. But financial conditions were very bad there. We couldn't support two of them at that time. So we had meetings in the YMHA and what to do. So we decided we had
Jewish
community center. The YMHA before Jewish community center was built. We decided in the chicken house they had the equipment there what to pluck the chickens by machine. Machine was going bad. We had no money or anything like this. So a member by the name of Mr. Epstein, he built. Then the $600 we bought a new plucking machine. And we're trying to figure out how to pay it back so we can. And we noticed that there wasn't enough money coming in from the chickens for being slaughtered. At that time, everybody used to have their own chickens slaughtered to sell. They used to buy it in the Haymarket and bring it over to the chicken house and have it slaughtered. Somehow there wasn't enough money coming in. So we moved over the meetings from the YMHA to our house here. Right to Little Lane, we had wonderful meetings, and we decided to, every time the shortcut or the slaughter, slaughter a chicken or any of the fowls, should put in an emblem. This way we'll know exactly how many chickens or geese or turkeys. It's a tag emblem. So then we'll know sure that the fowl has been slaughtered in a kosher way. And at the same time we'll be able to check up the income. Since then, our income has tripled and more than that. In a short time, we were able to pay Mr. Epstein's money right back. And we had extra money coming through it.
Went from fur to feathers.
Feathers. Of course, we had also difficulties with two butcher shops, and the Second World War is coming to climax and things like this. And we had a butcher shop on 7th Street, and he was closing up. And we had several of them on Preston Street, where most of the Jewish community was, Preston. Named Mr. Fuchs, and he was going out of business. So two young men who were one of them was in the grocery business, another one was a wholesale meat man, decided to open up a kosher butcher shop. Name was Weinberg. He died, he's dead since then. And the second one was Abe Hoffman. And they were doing real well. There was another one by the name of Mr. Schrager, older man, supposed to have the finest meat. And so we had quite a bit of trouble with the kosher slaughterers. Somehow they weren't satisfied with their salaries, things like that, and there also was supposed to be one of them was supposed to be taking care of Jewish circumcision. So finally, one of them moved away, and we had to get another one. So we got another man. And he wanted a lot more money, but he was a very good man for circumcision.
They called him a Moel.
It's called Moel, M-O-A-T-L. And he came from a big city and he wanted a lot of money, so our treasure was getting short again. So he finally quit and went to a different city, and we had to hire somebody else. And he had trouble. Some of the doctors didn't think he was doing a good job or so. So we were continuous worries all the time. So we had to bring in the men from out of town for circumcision. We had to bring in the men from either from Cincinnati or Indianapolis. So it was going on. Then we were only left with one man taking care of the slaughtering. And he didn't want to take care of both places. So we had to bring in a man from either from Cincinnati or Indianapolis to help out. And I had to leave in the middle of the business and pick him up either at the airport or pick him up at the bus station. And bring him back, it was taking quite a bit of my time. So for what? Doing it all for the community. So first.
Could you give me an approximate number of the Orthodox community that would be, you know, using these individuals you're talking about?
Well, it's very hard to say. We never took their names or anything.
Congregations, you can name a congregation.
It could be, the four congregations belongs to it. It was the one with Achim, it was in 12th and Jefferson at that time. There was Anshe Schwart, 1st and Walnut. There was a congregation out at Jeshurun, it's right in Woodburn right now. And Knesset Israel, which was at that time on Floyd and Jacob.
So it really was a large responsibility.
Well, the amount of people that Jewish kosher we don't know. We never could, but
there were thousands of them.
Well, that were very thousands. We decided that in order to bring in more money, we should have promote sales kosher. At one time, when we had a sale that time, for instance, on kosher hamburger, we advertised 35 cents a pound. That itself is sold 5,000 pounds for hamburger. And so besides other meat, which hamburger was not very popular at the time, steaks were very reasonable. So we must have quite a number of people, but we never could know definitely how many. Besides having people, private people, also have the Jewish hospital who uses kosher, has a kosher kitchen, and every congregation has a kosher kitchen. So does the Jewish community center has a kosher kitchen. And then the day school, they have a kosher kitchen. So at that time, we used to use about 12,000 pounds of kosher meat. And fowls, we estimate around 450
a week.
450. Mm. Then the frozen meat and packaging meat came in style and kind of broke in part of our income. A lot of them used to buy it. We had no income from the meat that's been sold to come from out of town.
You never mentioned that you each butcher paid a certain tax or levy on every pound of meat, which went into the
paying for the slaughter.
Which paid for the
slaughtering and keeping
and,
the mikvah.
And the moil or the circumciser, right?
Yes. Used to pay 3.5 cents a pound of meat before they're trimmed. That paid for all the expenses. And while a lot of the frozen chickens and frozen meat came in style, our income declined, and we saw the butcher shop, so we were left with less butchers. So we only had left 2 butchers left at that time. And we had to scrape again to pay for our circuit, also for our circumcision. I also will mention that time that we wanted to be sure that we are having the ones who sell kosher should really be kosher, should not be kosher style, like some of them call it, just a kosher style. So we had influence in Frankfurt during the session of, I'm not sure exactly the year, it was when, 1967. I have it in the records here. They passed a law, the kosher law, which we copied from the New York State law, that every store should have, which sells kosher, should have a sign, at least 4 letters, 4 inches size, we sell kosher only. And the one who does not sell kosher, low sells kosher, non-kosher, every sign we sell kosher and non-kosher, in order should people who observe kosher should not get confused. So the people who are real kosher usually buy in place sell kosher only. And that was one of the great things we have accomplished in a small town. For the Jewish community is probably...
It was a state law.
It's a state law. For the Jewish
community. It became a state law.
Oh yeah, it became a state law. It's still in effect.
It still is.
In effect. But it has never been tried, but it still is in effect. I have written number of letters to people who used to sell kosher and did not have a sign. Immediately they obeyed the law. Either they stopped selling kosher or else they had a sign put in their windows.
Didn't other states also write you all and states, ask you for the setup
we have
and the basis of how they established the law kosher. And they followed that
followed.
Also. Other states of the United States.
The state followed the
and
same
thing.
Other cities. But right now, at present, we do not have a real kosher butcher shop because most of the meat comes or used or frozen and comes in packaged. And it was hard for us to get a kosher slaughter because the last one we had left for Israel, we couldn't have anyone to replace him. Like anything else, so for a while we were getting meat from Cincinnati and Chicago, but it was they too had trouble because they didn't have enough slaughters and they couldn't get the right type of meat. So So we all we're depending mostly right now on meat that's coming in from Chicago or Cincinnati. And they can purchase it either direct from Chicago or direct from Cincinnati. It is delivered to every home if you call for it.
So there's no middle person here?
There is no middle person present here. Of course, there chain stores are allowed to sell packaged meat. We are given permission to sell kosher packaged meat as long as the seal is not broken. They can sell as kosher. Once it's broken, we have no authority over it. But we do not have any income on it.
That's what
it is.
That's important.
Yeah.
To keep these other things going.
What we do have income is when the state took over the ritual bathhouse or mikveh, the building belonged to Vada Kashrus, and the state paid us $42,000 for it.
The one on Walnut Street?
That's the one on Walnut, 208 East Walnut. And we built one on the Ansisfar grounds in New Mikveh. It was built without profit, so the whole thing cost us about $15,000. So we had some money left, and part of the money went to the Hebrew school, and part of the money went to the Vada Kashrus. And we invested the money in the fireside building loan, and we get interest. That interest we pay the insurance for the mikveh, and also for the water and heat. So we have enough at present. Of course, there's no other expenses we have except plumbing expenses when if anything goes wrong in the bathhouse.
Would be interesting to say that truly that your kosher law was helped passed by an Irish Catholic.
Yes. And a Jewishman.
Senator. Michael Duffy.
Yeah, Senator Duffy, yes.
Who was very instrumental in getting it passed.
Jewish senator by name of Weintraub. He was from Covington, Kentucky. They brought it in with most people, with, of course, the Jewish population in the state of Kentucky is probably less than 1%. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the state went along with it, as long as it didn't interfere with their interests and didn't interfere with the
humane laws.
Humane laws, and they would define that kosher slaughtering is very humane, most humane there is. I'm not going to describe you how it's been done, because that's not my job, but it's supposed to be very humane.
And
so,
it's done according to tradition.
Tradition would be
thousands,
done for thousands
of
years
old.
Ago.
Thousands
so,
of years old.
Thousands of years old.
They found the same ritualistic pattern.
But I don't think it'll be necessary. So is there anything else if you want me to say, I'll dare to talk to you about it.
Did you want to talk about the Hebrew Home for Courts? You worked there?
The Hebrew, yes. Well, most of the people who lived in downtown after the flood, they started moving up in the Highlands or so forth. So the congregations were getting empty there. And they started building new congregations in the Highlands. And so they also decided to build a Jewish home. and old.
For the aged.
Oh, home for the aged. On the butter grants from Taylor family used to be Mayor Taylor in Louisville. She's still there.
It's on Millville Road.
It's on Millville Road, just.
You're telling me.
Which runs right in the back of Millville and Ellaby between that. They have around 35 residents there. So they also have a chapel. They have services Friday night, Saturday morning, and Saturday evening, and major holidays. The one undertook to take care of it was a man by the name of Mr. Saul Wolman.
He was the first president.
He was the first president of the chapel. It was built in 49. Yeah, in 49. But at that time they had a number of people used to have services every day there. They have a number of people who were interested in it, and they had more. But now, somehow, they've been getting less and less people there. The trouble with the fire department and all that, so they kind of cut down the number of residents, so they only have around, minimum around 35 residents right now.
Well, but they have a hospital site.
That's all they have altogether right now, right, because right. The fire department wouldn't allow very much. The hospital site, it was have most of them.
Well, I mean, they have the home for the aged, and they also have a
hospital. They build a hospital site right there on the first floor. They have about 20 rooms for the hospital site. And the second floor is for residents who can
take care of themselves,
yes. And those people, even the ones in the hospitals, I also come into the chapel. And most, but the
remember there must always be 10 men there.
10 men too.
And they go through the entire service, mm-hmm. that would be in any Sabbath synagogue, the whole, right?
Yeah.
I think it's more interesting to note that, and that none of the people that run the services, Joe, don't you think that would be interesting to say?
Yeah.
None of them are professional people, but they're all, most of them are very educated, and they are qualified, like, to read the Torah, which many rabbis cannot do, you see.
Every one of them is qualified. So there are certain individuals who help make the chapel besides
the minion,
or it means minion, means a certain congregation. Mm-hmm. And they're not all professionals, they're all working men or
professional
men or businessmen.
Well, you take part in this service, do you?
I take part of it. Since Mr. Waldman died, I took over, and I'm just the head of the department. I have charge of the chapel.
He and Mr. Waldman designated him as what? As his successor. It's certainly not a dynasty, but
yeah. Well,
to uphold the
traditional services
as they've always been through the centuries.
In fact, I have. He gave me the permission, which the board of directors gave him full permission to do whatever he pleases, what he thinks is right. So he gave me the same permission that I don't have to go to the board and ask for certain things. I just decide myself what to do. We never asked the board for money or anything we do. We try to members to come to help at to perform services, try to get the money to themselves. Certain things we have to buy, certain, like we have to buy wine.
Sacramental wine.
We also have, after services, we have a certain kind of party. We have kiddish, you call. We have cakes and cookies and things like that. It's all being brought in by individual parties. And so we don't have to go into the home and ask them for funds, except for janitor service and keeping that place in perfect good condition.
Beautiful chapel.
The chapel has been donated by the Shapiro family. They are the ones who also in the liquor business. They have the
liquor
distilleries. Can I mention the name of the distillery? Or see, it's called
Heaven Hill.
Old Heaven Hill and Heaven Hill. And they also have a number of stores called the Louisville stores. They have a number of different cities. So they are. Take a very big interest in the home and also many other Jewish affairs.
I've noticed in reading in the Jewish Post and Opinion that
yes,
quite fundraising things.
Yes. So Mr. Shapiro was the one who is dead now.
Moe Shapiro.
Was it Moe? I don't know what his name was. He was really he helped put up the old home. Well, anyway, everything is running very smoothly as far as the four courts, to call it, or the old home, as far as the chapel is concerned.
And I'm not one of the founders of it.
I was the founder of the day school. I was the first one to have the, I mentioned it before, that I was the first one to organize the day school, the first one to think of it and to bring it up. And I was the first secretary, but I gave up the job to Mr. Rothschild, who has long been dead since.
His children went there, and now his grandchildren.
Grandchildren are going to the day school now.
As ours. Even though when we say the school was organized, we mean people put up the money to buy the building and guarantee the salaries of the teachers. They had a kitchen, kosher kitchen, and then after they moved to the for a while they were in Anxious Farm congregation, which is right next to. I think it's interesting to know that I think that the Avada Kashrus took care of what we used to say it was a four-letter organization, so to speak. It took care of the meat. It also took care of getting kosher milk for Passover, for the Passover season. It took care of the mikveh, or the ritual bathhouse for religious purification. And it took care of the moel, who had to be a man who had to be a strict Sabbath observer. He also had to be trained in the ways of performing the circumcision, and he, needless to say, had to be a religiously observant man. If a child had a circumcision under other circumstances, they were not considered traditionally correct. And very often, was it not true that even, in fact, a friend of my son is a physician, and he had a friend of his whose father is a physician, and this young man is now a physician here in Louisville also, and he married a girl from France whom he met in Israel, and the rabbi from her city took great pains to learn whether he had undergone circumcision in the proper manner. My husband had a cousin who was from a very prominent Jewish family from Indianapolis. You know, there was a judge for many years, a very prominent judge. And he came to this city after he left his private practice in Indianapolis, and he served as the mole, or the circumcision man performing the circumcision for the city of Louisville, and also when there would be soldiers or any of them from Fort Knox, you know, and they would, if their wives would come and some of them would have children, they would have that done. And he served without any pay recompense, and in fact it cost him money, because he really took out insurance. Against malpractice in case something would happen, and his name was Dr. Harry S. Rabb, and I think he did it for what, 15, was it about 15 years? How many?
8 years.
Was it 8 years?
8 years, you see. 8 years. He was in the army 4 years in England as a surgeon. He said 4 years, and then he figured he's going to make 6 more years here in Louisville, in the veterans. He came here, the veterans, to make him 10 years, so he'd be eligible for army pension, retirement.
Wasn't he chief of admissions?
He was chief of admissions
for veterans.
But he stayed on 2 years longer than he was supposed to, because he could have retired 2 years earlier. He would have stayed on and on, but he brought in the place which he was head man on 13th and Broadway. They closed up that part, the apartment, and they went back to the main veterans hospital in Zora. And they brought in a man to be chief of that hospital who was not a medical man, who was an armed man. And just couldn't.
So
he left. Decided we left to get out of it. And doing a circumcision for us. But now we are bringing a man who's a surgeon from Cincinnati. He's a surgeon, but we have to pay him for it.
But these men had to also be Sabbath observers. Aside from their profession, they had to be, you know, they had to be very strict their observance, or they were not considered.
The one we're bringing now, he was a rabbi, and he's a surgeon now, he's a practicing surgeon. He's a real religious man. Never read the requirement. We call him, he flies in.
And the I think you should also make note that the Vada Kashrus had the congregations. They had the one, Agudath Achim. They had members. They were the ones who were down on Market Street, weren't they?
Jefferson. Jefferson? 11th Jefferson.
11th or 12th and Jefferson.
11th and 12th.
And they had representatives from Knesset Israel, Ad Sharon, Ansi Sfar, and really, there even were the their services that many times were called on upon by some of the Reform people who still observed certain rituals that were perhaps not exactly a formal part of their temple, but there were people that did.
And also, Fort Knox, and also people who are newcomers in the city and who do not belong to a congregation, also call on the Vaar to furnish them with a moil. It will be our responsibility to get them one at our expense, or else if we can pay for it, we take them the money.
And there are a number of, there have been and still are a number of professors, I'm sure, at the University of Louisville that are in some of the departments who are very observant and who make use of the kosher facilities. They make use of the mikveh, and they send their children to the day school, and I imagine many of them would not have come to the city had there not been these types of places.
Yes, yes, a lot of them would not come to the city. And that, the first thing they ask you, is there a kosher ritual at house, if there is a day school for the children in a place, I guarantee you can get kosher food, things like that. And that helps bring in certain professionals from the city, otherwise you couldn't.
If I was a newcomer to the city, how would I go about finding the central information?
Well,
what would I do?
You probably would call upon one of the congregations. The congregation would refer you to the right party.
Or imagine the conference of Jewish organizations.
Conference would also do. You don't want a conference. Usually a newcomer probably wouldn't know so much about the conference. They would look up in the telephone book and see for the Orthodox congregation, and call in the congregation and get all the information and all the help you can possibly need.
We like to say that when the day school was established, it was based on the principle that any child, any family that wanted to give their children a Hebrew education could do so if they could pay. They certainly were obliged to pay. If they could not pay, no child was ever refused admission for a financial reason. And we had children from all the Orthodox congregations, from the Conservative, and we always had them from the Reform also.
Sure.
And we still do. It has flourished. And they must, of course, follow. It's a double program. They must take all the courses and qualify for everything offered in the public schools.
According to state
and according to the state laws and the curriculum. And plus, it's a double program, and they must study all the Hebraic subjects, Bible, history, Hebrew language, modern Hebrew, and actually the religious traditions.
Religious laws.
Religious laws.
Do you feel that this has had a really important part in keeping the cohesiveness of the Orthodox community?
Yes.
Very much so. I think that without that, I don't think we would have the rabbi come to Louisville. We wouldn't have a number of professional men coming to the University of Louisville without them. I doubt if Rabbi Auerbach or doctors or Professor Siskin or many more would ever come to Louisville if they wouldn't have.
Dr. Namani was also served on our board of directors, naturally being a man of great knowledge
and such.
And we feel that especially since the Holocaust took and destroyed the seminaries, the great centers of learning, along with the people, but they were tremendous centers of learning and culture, that we felt that you could educate the youth in a more intensive way, and we never interfered in their private home or their beliefs. They were taught according to the traditional beliefs, Orthodox, and but what they did in their home was their own prerogative, and it only went up to and they added a year each year, we never had of our family in the school until our grandchildren went. And now my daughter, and my son-in-law, are members of the board, and they we've all had various offices since it's along with many other people and many other founders. And we feel that it has provided a continuity that we think is important to our culture and which we think is important to all cultures, not only ours. If people desire that, if they desire it, we think it's a very important thing. And especially in light of things that do go on today, we feel that it certainly will contribute, and we actually ourselves personally even support parochial schools, not of our own religious beliefs, but others, because no matter what they are, we feel that it is important. And we have also supported currently the Lebanese people who have many relatives here in Louisville through the St. Michael Orthodox Church, and such, since they were being murdered in the conflicts in the Middle East, we feel obligated to help people like that. And I think my husband did not say he is a modest man, but his father was a graduate of a theological seminary, which was like practically, if you were to say, like the Harvard of rabbinical seminaries of Europe. Of course, it's gone, but there are remnants of them there who are now in Israel and such. And we have enjoyed it all. Sometimes I often wondered whether we had a first door or if we were with the meat business, or we were with seeing that people had someone for their children, circumcise their children, and if someone wanted to use the ritual bathhouse or the mikveh for themselves, or they use for conversions to purification. Thing. Many things, and it has enriched our lives. We've had we have seen many really outstanding people of our faith have come into our home, the Chief Rabbi of Ireland, and all kinds of rabbis and people connected with, especially with educational endeavors. Would you say
yes,
some of the greatest people in the country have come in, and women.
Stayed in our house, yeah.
And been in our house and been guests. And
Dr. Lamb, who's now
the president
of the Yeshiva University.
And the rabbi who was Chief Rabbi of Ireland and now who is the Chief Rabbi
England,
of Great Britain, England and Great Britain. In fact, he was snowed in.
and the head of the Jewish Day Schools in the United States and Canada, Dr. Kamenetsky, has stayed here a number of times.
That's right. And we really feel that in our time that we have lived a great deal of the history of the school of Judaism, and its touch. And at times it's been controversial, because I think that any time you do anything, you have some people who believe one way and some people who believe the other.
See this picture? This was given, believe it or not, when I was president for 20 years.
Who are the other individuals on here with you?
Well, the one next to me is who is Vice President Ben Mazin.
He's an attorney.
And this is Robert Nyman to the left. He's our secretary. He's got all the information.
Okay, he's the gentleman we contacted.
Yes, he is.
He's director of research for Whitmix Corporation, and he's a world famous chemical engineer. And he has set up chemical standards for the Bureau of Standards for the United States government. And
he worked in the time bomb. During the war.
He didn't know it.
He was exempt from the army in the country with work.
He was working on the through his castings on the bomb site for the atomic bomb.
He didn't know what he was working on.
He's been secretary of the Vada Kashrus almost as long as my husband had.
No, not quite as long as
not
but,
quite.
About 5 years less.
And
this is this one's always been interesting about Cassius. Recognize
him. I can't. Rabbi Rudman?
No.
Well, tell her. It's on there.
Yeah.
You're being recorded, Joe.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't want to waste her.
Not one waste her.
Tell her.
You see, his father-in-law, Mr. Kelman, was also, he was in charge of the Rite of Kashrus, and this is Ben, what's his last name? I remember.
Ben Krauss.
Krauss, yeah.
Ben Krauss. He was treasurer at
one
time. And it has encompassed a great many people. But we would like to say that, truthfully, all these things that we're speaking about today, that down on West Broadway, when the German Jews, who were the first Jews to settle in Louisville, they had a mikveh in their temple or synagogue, whatever they called it. You know, in those days, it's synonymous, the word. Wouldn't you say the word is synonymous? And that certainly was in the 19th century, early, wasn't it?
Yes, early 19th century. And from Broadway, of course, it's
on Broadway, and most of them at that time observed religious dietary laws. Some still might, some do not. And they also had a ritual bathhouse then, and it's a connection with the past and with the future. I think that's the most important thing about it. And so we've had our part along with it.
Well, I hope the information will help you somehow, I don't know.
And then our children, we always took our children on Saturday. They had Sabbath services over at the day school, and although we took our children there. And then when the day school moved and went over to the Jewish Community Center, and most of the people who were going over to the day school, who are Sabbath observers and don't ride or something, and not some do and some don't, they go over to Four Courts, and they have, it's a very beautiful chapel, and they have services, the same services that's conducted in the Orthodox congregations. And our children went there, and we took our grandchildren there in baby buggies and Taylor Tots. And our son, who is a physician now, if he comes in town, whenever he is in town, he also goes there, and we all go together. And there are a number of families who do the same. We are not alone. There are a number of them. And strangely enough, I would say that the services at the Home for the Aged, the people participating in them are getting younger all the time. Wouldn't you say? They're certainly much younger than when they began. There are teachers there. There are professors there. There are associate professors of all types. There are medical students. The man and his wife come there. They're medical students. There's a man and his wife who are this one man who is with the financial part of the financial writer for the Courier Journal, and he's observant, is he not? He's an observant person too, and they come with the ones that have little babies. They wheel them in, and it's quite interesting. Rather than getting older, it's getting younger.
They're mostly newcomers in the city
who have settled in this area.
Well, the medical student and his wife is her father. Certainly, he's an anesthesiologist, is he not?
Yeah.
And she happened to marry a young man from St. Louis, and so now they come here. But she's not a newcomer to Louisville. I wouldn't say that. And there's
a professor who teaches in the University of Indiana.
Yes, and then we have a professor who teaches in the University of Indiana who comes there, who is also, I'm sure, a graduate of a seminary, although he doesn't practice as a rabbi or anything. I'm sure he probably could.
Yes, he's just like the Dr. Auerbach? No, he teaches at the University of Louisville.
Yes.
He teaches Hebrew and Eastern, Near East.
And it's strange how the different things have evolved, you see, with the Hebrew school taking over the bathhouse, and then when the Hebrew school was moved, and then with the demise of the mikveh, how an organization was formed, and then that's when my husband became president, and they built a very, very modern facility.
Most modern in the country. Everything's self-service. You press a button and you have 700 gallons of a pool, 700 gallons of hot water in 5 minutes. And you press a button and the water goes out.
And there were representatives from each congregation who were members of the board. So it was always a democratic, really a democratic group.
Always.
And of course, usually the people who were representatives were chosen for their background or their knowledge, so that they could carry on these traditions properly. And my husband, weren't you chairman, one of the chairmen for the sale of war bonds during World War II? that he was too, along with the, I don't know, a little bit of everything.
Yes, everything.
And you wonder why we won't interview you.
No.
But there were people who worked much harder.
Well, you've done it. You've just really contributed.
Well, the kosher law was really a very important thing. It stopped misrepresentation and it kept things on the proper keel, you know, as it should be. Yeah. You have good people, you have charlatans and everything. Mm-hmm. so you have to take care of them too. So, but you never really had too much trouble. Most everyone observed it, didn't they?
Everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
the only trouble we had is just mostly changing with the butchers. They just didn't like the idea that we should give Morris what to do.
Well, the one thing I will say that my husband foresaw many years ago, and he recommended, and the modern supermarket and the ways of applying these very ancient things in such a way so that they can be just as modern as any of them.
I've been bringing up at meetings as much as 15 years ago. Care. Well, the slaughterhouse before we bought it, before we started taking care of it. You see, that's where Travis would have paid. I believe this will be some of the regulation functions of the cost. If you want to, you can have that.
Okay. I'll make a copy and send this back to you.
Good.
If you don't mind.
Oh, sorry.
How about this? Could I make a copy
of
that?
You can. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can have that. Yes. And this is the last thing there was. If you want a copy of this, you could too.
All right.
Take the whole thing. This was recently, surely, yes.
But
2 years ago. That was a question over there by Glickman Bennett. You saw that Rabbi Rudman is the chief. It'll answer a lot of questions in history.
Well, I really want to thank both of you. I just appreciate you talking with us and having these memories go down on tape. And you're free to add to them anytime you want to. And I certainly like to look at the records that you
exactly
have.
Exactly, if it was as historical as you wanted it.
The only thing I can think of right at the end that I did not ask you follow up on is your parents, how long they survived here in they buried here in Louisville?
Yeah, buried in Louisville, yes. My father died in 1942. My mother died in 65, I believe.
John was 16.
Joy was
in July was 1941. When was Pearl Harbor?
41. He was a year old. My father died.
Died in 42.
Yeah.
And your mother
died 16 years afterwards.
Your mother died on July
16th. Mm-hmm. She was 15 years afterwards then. She's 50, she was a year old.
So it was in the 50s?
Yeah, 57, 58.
I believe you told me, but right this minute I can't remember. What was your father involved in business-wise when he
was
younger?
Well, he was not much in business. He was a custom peddler. Those days he used to go out and sell dresses and clothing to from house to house, and it was in the
That's
early
how
days.
A lot of the
people,
the old stores. In fact, that's how Neiman Marcus started. It's strange to see. But he never got that far.
And you were selling your coats at the wrestling matches anyway, too, weren't you?
Oh, yes. And his, I think one thing that was very funny is that and when he used to sell soft drinks, this was before my era, but he told me, you can see he's quite a slim man now, and he was about 115 pounds when we got married, and when he was younger, they used to sell soft drinks and racing forms and newspapers, anything, you know.
Saturday night at 11 o'clock and get up Sunday morning at 4 o'clock and again sell paper at Fifth and Walnut.
And the cathedral there, too. Yeah, Fifth and Walnut. I remember he told me he used to see many people there. He had to know all the merchants downtown, the old merchants, even the young ones. And one of the people at the racetrack wanted to ask him to become a jockey. And he was thrilled. He wanted to be one, but when he came back home to his father, the rabbi, his father wouldn't hear of it. So the prospective jockey became a furrier. He still is.
Oh.
I thought it was funny myself.
Well, racing's loss was a furrier's gain, right?
Anyway.
Thank you so much.